From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
Last September, a 40-mile-long crack opened in a remote region of Ethiopia's Rift Valley called Afar. Satellite images reveal that it's the largest magmatic rift ever seen. With me now is geophysicist Roger Buck, who has visited the crack and is analyzing its significance. He's part of a team at the Laman Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Buck to my show today. Hi.
Thanks, Leonard.
So what does this crack look like and how wide is it?
So what the satellite showed was that an area 40 miles long opened up, and along most of the length, big faults dropped down. And then an area almost 40 miles wide moved suddenly one side to the other. And essentially this is accommodating the motion of Arabia moving away from the main part of Africa.
So this is bigger than the Grand Canyon, at least in terms of width.
Well, but it's not very deep. It only dropped a few meters in this particular event. The significance is that we've never seen anything open this wide and this long before.
And did it happen suddenly?
As far as we know, about a year and a week ago, there was a spate of seismicity that was picked up around the world. And in 2 days, there were about 160 events between magnitude 4 and 5. And that's what tipped people off that something was going on.
But, so is this like an earthquake, or is this more like a volcanic eruption?
It's both. That's what's interesting about it, is that there are very few places on Earth where you get both areas spreading apart and magma coming in that we can get to and walk on. Now, the mid-ocean ridges are like that. There's about 40,000 kilometers of mid-ocean ridges that where the plates are spreading apart. But only on Iceland and in the Afar can you actually walk on these.
Well, in the case of Iceland, it's getting the mid-ocean ridge, the end of the mid-ocean ridge, isn't it? It's where
exactly.
The Atlantic
it's
is
splitting apart.
It's
the mid-Atlantic ridge
apart.
Coming up on land.
But what's happening here?
Well, here it's the southern end of the Red Sea coming into a kind of a little bit more complicated area, because actually you've got three rifts coming together. You have the East African Rift, you have the Aden Rift that makes up the Gulf of Aden, and then you get the 2,000-kilometer-long Red Sea Rift.
Are these the kinds of rifts that we hear about when paleoanthropologists talk about looking for ancient fossils?
Well, this is the area where Lucy was found and where there have been several other hominid finds in the last year. And it may be because rift valleys are good places to preserve fossils, because sediment is coming from the higher topography on the sides into the valley.
But also, I'd imagine, the rift opens up layers of earth that we would have had to have dug very deeply into. Now suddenly they're exposed.
That's not true. That's not where you find the fossils in this area, because what's exposed on the side is, well, if you could see all the way through it in Ethiopia, is a pile of 3 kilometers of basalt that was poured out 30 million years ago in a much bigger magmatic event.
So when I look into this crack, what am I seeing? Am I seeing boiling magma?
Well, not presently. You might in a couple of years. If this follows the pattern that rifting and magmatic events have followed in Iceland, then in a couple of years we could have a huge outpouring of magma.
But right now I could jump in there and walk?
Well, right now the magma is about 2 kilometers down, about a mile and a half down. And it probably extends, given the satellite observations and our interpretation of them, the magma crack extends down about 6 miles.
Well, it's magma is hot. So do you feel the heat even on the surface?
Well, on the surface.
Or is a mile and a half too far down for it to happen?
Well, near the most volcanic part of this rift, there are a series of hot springs, and that's the only reason that that end of the rift is inhabited with nomad sheep and goat herders, because the hot springs bring up enough water for people to live on.
Now, when an earthquake is about to occur or when a volcano is about to blow, we kind of get indications of it. Were scientists aware that this sort of thing was going to happen here?
Well, we've known for a long time that this area could have this kind of event, but this event took up about 1,000 years of plate spreading, so it doesn't happen that often, so we're very lucky to have it. The first seismicity, the first indication that something was going on, happened in early September last year, and by the 26th, this thing had cracked open, and it actually blew out a bit of explosive magma as well.
How soon after it opened did you get there?
Well, I wasn't the first. I was actually kind of a reluctant participant in this. I'm a theorist who works on why these cracks happen and where they happen and what are the conditions. The first people who came in was a group organized by the Ethiopians in Addis Ababa, and it included a friend of mine who was a professor at the time in England, and she brought in 10 seismometers, and with government help, with army help, because it's a very difficult desert area to get around, they flew in and put these seismometers out, and that was in mid-October, and that's when they realized this wasn't just a sequence of earthquakes. This was a really special kind of event.
Now, you said that this is an area where three tectonic plates meet.
Right.
Does that happen elsewhere? I always thought it was just two.
No, that happens in a fair number of places. In the Indian Ocean it happens, in the southern South Atlantic. So it's not that uncommon.
Do these sorts of things, you say we're not aware of these sorts of things elsewhere because they tend to be under the water.
Right, and it's extremely difficult to see these things underwater. It's expensive to get ships out. It's very difficult to get instruments that can stay down and monitor areas, especially because these sort of events don't happen that often. But interestingly enough, last January, there was another event, something like this, on the East Pacific Rise. And some colleagues of mine had seismometers out on the particular segment that was active and is still active now.
Is this area mostly desert?
This is a low basaltic desert. It's a very rugged area, and the people there are the toughest people I've ever seen.
Now, is there some irony in the fact that all of the other rifts of this sort take place underwater, and here we have a rift that's in one of the drier parts of Earth?
Well, it's actually part of the dry area that where they mine salt now was actually underwater for a while and got essentially dammed off when a fault block rotated up and dammed the Red Sea out of the area.
When was it underwater? We're talking about hundreds of thousands of years ago, millions of years ago. My guest is Roger Buck, who is telling us about a rift that opened in the Rifi, in the Afar Valley.
The Afar.
Of Ethiopia about a year ago, a little over a year ago, 40 miles long. And you were talking about the people who were there. You say these are really tough people. How welcoming were they to you and the other scientists who showed up?
Well, they were incredibly welcoming to us, but we had to go in because there's some potential of running into rebels from Eritrea. We were less than 100 kilometers from Eritrea, and the border is disputed with Ethiopia.
And there's been a war on and off.
And a very serious war off and on. And it's such a remote area that the people told us that the center of this rift is actually the perfect place for bandits to hide. For rebels, the grain of the territory runs straight towards Eritrea. And it's very difficult to go across the grain. You essentially can't get across without a helicopter or climbing equipment. But going along it is easy. And there are these hot springs that people can live on in the mountains. And so we had to go in with a fair number of gunmen. First, we picked up militiamen in the provincial capital. And one other reason that the provincial government was so interested in this is that this rift lines up in a straight line towards their new capital, where they're building a huge earthen dam across the only river that goes into the area.
So that earthen dam is endangered, I would assume.
Definitely.
But there is some symbolism here. We have Eritrea, which used to be part of Ethiopia.
Right.
but broke away after they got rid of Mengistu, the dictator who everybody hated. That was part of the deal of getting rid of Mengistu. And then they have been fighting ever since. So there, we have a political rift,
exactly.
and then a physical rift here.
Right.
And I we posted a slideshow of the photos from your trip on our website, and I noticed those guns there. I thought, why do they need those? I would understand seismographic equipment and the like.
Well, we were never quite sure whether they really needed them, whether there was really this much danger. We certainly heard stories from people I met. I got to know the only person I could communicate with directly was a merchant in a very small village whose name was Ishmael, and he spoke a little French, so I could communicate directly with him. And what I got from him was how scared he was to go with us beyond the sort of territorial boundary around his village, about 20 kilometers away. And he was 50 years old. He'd never been beyond that boundary. And he was convinced that he would be shot if he was there. And we had some inkling that things may still be difficult between different groups when we'd go along ridgelines, and you would see these big mounds of rock along the ridgelines. And I asked a couple of people about it, and I got mixed answers. And the most complete answer I ever got was that they were special kinds of graves. They were graves of people that were killed by the neighboring peoples, and they buried them up there as essentially a reminder to kill somebody from the neighboring area. But this sort of very open hostilities between different regions definitely goes back a few generations. But we weren't really sure why every male above 12 had an AK-47, whether it was just for show or for need.
What language do they speak? You said you found somebody who spoke French, but did they speak Amharic?
No, they don't. They speak Afari. It's a totally different root language. It's a Cushitic language. So we had to have local people from the government translating. So if we spoke English to the Amharic speakers, they spoke to the Afaris, and the Asparis went back to them.
Now, in Iceland, there's a lot of geothermal activity. In fact, it's what keeps that very northern country as warm as it is. Is there geothermal activity here in Ethiopia, which is rather hot?
There is. And some of the scientists whom I know in Ethiopia have actually been to Iceland to visit the geothermal power plants.
Does it look similar?
Well, it looks very similar in certain ways. The biggest difference, and it was one thing I really liked about Ethiopia, and I've spent about a year and a half in Iceland, is that Iceland has been covered periodically by glaciers. And when volcanoes erupt under glaciers, they make complicated landforms that confuse everything else that's going on. And there haven't been any glaciers in this area.
Well, in Iceland, that's the alternative to global warming, I imagine. But here, you say, obviously, there are no glaciers. But still, since you've been to Iceland and you've studied the mid-ocean ridges, did it look similar?
Well, what it reminded me of most of all was pictures that people have put together from certain mid-ocean ridges, particularly the Juan de Fuca Ridge, the ridge that's off the northwest coast of the United States, off Cascadia. And it's a particular kind of ridge it's spreading at, we'd say, an intermediate rate. Doesn't have a deep valley, but has very distinct faults that are very long. And that was the most exciting thing for us to see. I'm used to working in extensional places like the western U.S., where faults have a particular arcuate shape. They die out, and they tend to be about 100 times as long as they are offset vertically. Here we saw faults and new breaks that were just meter-sized breaks on 30-kilometer-long faults. And the reason is that you have to have these special conditions of a fluid-filled crack underneath that doesn't make it to the surface.
So this is very different than what happens in California with faults like the San Andreas?
It's very different. There, at San Andreas, the plates are just moving sideways. Here, the plates are moving apart. And my great interest is
sideways, because so they kind of shift a bit, and something that was next to another thing now is an inch away.
Now things are, in this area, Saudi Arabia is moving further away, about a little over a centimeter and a half. It's moving away on an average rate that your toenails grow.
Does Osama bin Laden know that Saudi Arabia is moving away?
Oh, I don't know. I did see, this is a Muslim area, I did see kids wearing Osama bin Laden T-shirts, which didn't make me feel particularly good.
Well, what do you gain from being there firsthand? Could you have just stayed in New York and looked at the data?
Well, I could have, since I mostly work on the theory. But last year at a meeting out in San Francisco, a group of friends of mine who were planning to go there they had to go there in January to get data off the seismometers that this friend of mine, Cindy Ebinger, put out in October, because they only had 3 months of memory. And another colleague of mine, Eric Calais at Purdue, wanted to put out GPS instruments to get more accurate estimates of the deformation around the area now. We only get snapshots from the satellites every couple of months. And the guy from Oxford, Tim Wright, who did the satellite work, all three of them got together with me in a bar in San Francisco, and they needed more people to go out. And I was already involved in work on how these things happen, but they twisted my arm and convinced me to go.
And you obviously didn't regret it. Well, how long did you stay?
Well, we're in Ethiopia just for 2.5 weeks. And one interesting thing about it was that Cindy Ebinger is the only one of us who is really an East Africa hand. A couple of us had visited there to go to meetings. None of us had ever worked in East Africa, and she's worked there for 25 years. But she couldn't go with us because she was doing some work in Oman on another part of the rift system. And we were on our own. We had one fantastic scientist, Elias Louis, from Addis Ababa, who was our translator and our diplomat go-between. And we had letters of introduction from the president of Ethiopia, the minister of the interior, and we visited the president of the FR, and down the line to make sure we were protected everywhere we went. And then eventually we went out into the rift with camels carrying our equipment. And
you can't go by car.
You can go by car part of the way, and it's fairly difficult just by car. You have to go up dry river valleys for most of the way. This is an area 100 kilometers from any power lines, any civilization. People had never seen Westerners in this area. At least the younger kids had never seen anybody like us. And then where it gets very rugged, you can go by camel. Then camels can't go beyond that.
Then you sleep in tents, I assume.
We just slept out in the open. In the wintertime there, it's actually pretty comfortable.
Now, I imagine that the movement is continuous. Why do we suddenly get breaks? Is it just that this is kind of like something letting off steam? The pressure builds up so much that we're letting off steam and then a rift develops?
It's something like that, but we actually don't know the detailed answer to that question. We have so few observations of places like this. I mean, in Iceland, we have 1,100 years of historical record, and only a handful of rifts have opened up like this in that time, and only one in the last century. And I've studied that in some length with my colleagues there. We only have one place on the Mid-Ocean Ridge System submarine where we've seen these events. So we don't have enough data. We have some ideas about what controls the episodicity of this, but it's not really known.
I'd assume that in Iceland we have a lot more eyewitness accounts of it actually happening.
Right.
Did anybody observe this as the Earth started pulling apart?
Yes. In the northern part of this rift area where there are all these hot springs and people live, people claim they lost camels into the cracks that were opening up, these fissures that were opening up, and they saw false move. They claimed one shepherd said they went to sleep one night, left their flock up in one area, and the next day the flock was a meter higher than it had been before. It had a longer walk up to get to them.
You're a geophysicist. What does that mean? I assume it's a mixture of geologist and physicist.
Right. Well, it's a funny mix because, as you probably know, physics is really deductive science. You have to
mostly equations.
Analyze everything. And I deal with the equations. I'm not the intrepid person who would normally be the first person out into this sort of an area. And one of the reasons I don't run to go is that I'm not as skilled as real geologists have to have an encyclopedic memory for what they see. And they have to have an artist's eye for spatial relations that they see. And that's something that somebody with more of a physics background tends not to have.
So you're mixing the two. You're kind of a compromise between the two. But
exactly.
I imagine there are other geophysicists who are stronger in one area than
exactly.
the other. And you share notes and try to figure it all out. How much of
exactly.
the work are you going to be doing here then?
Well, what I'm doing here is taking some of the data that we're getting back. And with students, we're trying to do models, some just conceptual models, pencil and paper, and some on computers, to simulate what happened.
And then predict what will happen in the future. I'm assuming that if this rift has opened now, it's not going to close. It's going to continue opening.
Well, it was funny. After we got back from the field, I gave a talk at the University of Addis Ababa. And I was the only person in this group who'd ever studied these kind of events before. They'd done a lot of work in the field. They knew the technical aspects of doing these measurements. But I'd worked in Iceland a lot. And they said, well, from what you know of Iceland, is this going to happen? Are we going to have more events? And I said, well, I don't know. We have so little data. If it's like Iceland, we'll have more events. If it's different, and it had been different already, none of the Icelandic events were so big to begin with. But last June 17th, another sequence of earthquakes happened, and the satellites picked up that another 2 meters of opening happened. So we're expecting more. We're going back. My colleagues are going back with a BBC crew and a Scientific American crew next month. I'm teaching, so I can't go, but I might go in January to go again.
Are there any cycles, or is this just coincidental that something happened in Iceland around the same time that something happened in Ethiopia?
Well, I think there's so many different segments of the mid-ocean ridge system that any one should be going off. There should be one going off around the world every few weeks, but we can't see most of them. But the interesting cycle actually is the very long-term cycle. And my particular interest in magma and rifting is the fact that every now and then, about every 30 million years, giant pulses of magma seem to come out, and you get giant rift events. And it's the only time, it seems like, when very large-scale continents break apart. Like New York was adjacent to Morocco until 200 million years ago, and there was a huge outpouring, one of the biggest outpourings of magma and intrusions. The Palisades Sill was formed at the time. And we know now
it was connected to Africa, the Palisades.
Because
we know, because of the geology is the same.
Well, you can trace back through the oceans, through the transform faults, through the structures in the oceans, how things fit up, and you can match up the geology as well.
Well, and if you look at South America and Africa, you see they almost fit together.
It's
like
a perfect
like
fit,
a
and that area
puzzle.
Had been sitting there for 500 million years, not moving, essentially no activity. Then there was a huge burst of volcanism about 120 million years ago, and that's when they split apart.
You're going to be speaking at the Explorers Club tonight. Do you think of yourself at all as an explorer?
Well, it's funny. I think of myself more as a pencil and paper explorer, an explorer of ideas. But I love to be associated with people who are exploring the world, getting new data. We're a science that absolutely relies on people going out and getting new information like this.
Well, you've lived in Iceland for a while to study the rifts there. Mm-hmm. Would you want to live in Ethiopia as well, or is it just too tough?
Well, the Afar would be an extremely tough place to live. Most of the rest of Ethiopia is comparatively much more comfortable. It's one of the poorest countries, probably the second poorest country in Africa. But once I got out of the Afar after a couple of weeks, I realized how relatively rich people were up on the plateau. And the plateau is high enough that it's cool, it gets monsoon rains, it's lush. It's still very poor, but it's a very comfortable place to be.
Roger Buck will be giving a lecture at the Explorers Club, as I said, called From Satellites to Camels, the Biggest Magmatic Rift Event. That's tonight at 6:30 till 8:45. The Explorers Club is at 46 East 70th Street. It's open to the public, and tickets will be sold at the door on a first-come, first-served basis beginning at 6 p.m. More information at explorersclub.org. And you can also check out that slideshow I was mentioning earlier at our website here at WNYC.org. Thank you so much, Mr. Buck, for being with us.
It was a great pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, Elizabeth Edwards talks about being diagnosed for advanced breast cancer during her husband's vice presidential campaign. And then ABC correspondent Lynn Scherr on 40 years as a reporter, plus the man People magazine voted the sexiest astrophysicist alive, Neil deGrasse Tyson. And Ruth Reichel and John Willoughby of Gourmet seek out the country's 50 best restaurants. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. We had help today from Brad Ludlow. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.